Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When Christmas falls on a Wednesday, that means the day before Christmas is a Tuesday and the day after Christmas is a Thursday, and that may not be great for the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for December 25th, and it's great to have you with us, as always. Today is Christmas. It's also Wednesday. The holiday is smack dab in the middle of the week. For many shoppers, retailers, employers, and employees, that combo can knock everything out of sync, and everything includes the economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
It may have been hard to tell if you were scrambling through the mall earlier this week, but things have actually been a bit slow. ShopperTrack reports there were 21% fewer people shopping during the week that ended Sunday compared to last year. Sales were down 3%.
I think this is one of the most stressful Christmas weeks because the days between Thanksgiving and Christmas are shorter, plus Christmas is falling on a Wednesday. So that means that people are in massive time crunch.
That's consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow at Golden Gate University. She says a lot of us will get just today off. Most employers don't give the day after Christmas as a gift, and many employees can't afford to take any extra time as vacation. Yarrow points out this happens about every 7 years. It's sort of biblical.
So it's like the arrival of the locusts. Not the best year in terms of both enjoyment of the holidays and also, I think, productivity at work.
As much as I love everyone in the family, I'm dreading the fact that I have to get up the next morning and be at work because I have meetings.
That's consumer analyst Patty Edwards at U.S. Bank, and she says retailers dread the calendar this year, too.
We know that the most ideal time for Christmas to land is on a Monday because you have the entire weekend to shop, and then you can just relax and the retailers get what they want.
Edwards says Christmas on Wednesday is the worst timing for retailers because we all had to shop and work on Monday and Tuesday. Although, flip side,
online sales for those folks who got gift cards will probably be higher on December 26th this year because it is a Thursday.
And she says people will be shopping from their desks instead of working. Next week will also be a productivity mess at work when New Year's Day falls on a Wednesday. At least tomorrow, when people do go back to work or out sale shopping again, one stressor will be removed.
Oh, you better watch out. Better not cry.
That ubiquitous Christmas mall music. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's never been easier to buy things and to return them, especially online. Shipping is free, and there's that return label pre-printed inside each and every box. On top of that, shipping on returns is also free. Well, that's great for shoppers. It's not easy for retailers. As Marketplace's Noelle King reports, while retailers will never love returns, they're recognizing they can learn from them.
Tracy Poston loves shopping online at J.Crew and Ann Taylor. It's easy and convenient. But since she's never sure what's going to fit,
I'll tend to order an item in multiple sizes and see which one fits me best.
Whatever doesn't work, she returns, by mail or to the store itself. And for her fiancé, who hates shopping,
what I'll tend to do is order him maybe 5 or 6 items, have him try them on at home, and then whatever he doesn't like, I'll take it back to the store.
With free shipping and returns, online shopping has become a lot like traditional shopping. You try on lots of stuff and only keep what you want. Paul Argenti of Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business doesn't expect that to change for a while.
I don't see how you can operate in a world where people can't go through the different products and try them on online unless there's some new technology that allows us to, you know, really get the size and the color right.
All of the buying and returning has created a headache for online retailers, but it's also created a big mound of data.
You know, what you're browsing on the website, what you're clicking on, what colors you looked at, and what products have you purchased or added to your cart.
Omer Artun is the CEO of Agile One, which tracks and analyzes shopping behavior. Retailers use that information to pitch you items they think you'll like, based on the styles, colors, and sizes you've ordered and kept. The data is also useful on a bigger scale. Scott Cassiato is a vice president at ModCloth, an online retailer that sells women's clothes, shoes, and accessories.
If we're just seeing a product that continues to be returned and is not really a hit, yeah, we'll make different buying decisions based on that, for sure.
So ModCloth can pull those ill-fitting lime green capri pants from the virtual shelves before you buy them and send them back. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed. If you're sipping eggnog or roasting chestnuts, well, rest assured, we'll have some holiday numbers to keep you in a merry mood. This year on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, more than 92 million Americans took advantage of sales. 92 million. Well, there's another group of holiday shoppers who couldn't care less about a doorbuster or if something's 50 or 75% off, and there are plenty of businesses that cater to them. These customers expect the best, period, and they're willing to pay for it. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Eric Drachman brings us that story from Los Angeles.
It's a fabulous tree. That is a fabulous tree.
Clay Storseth is known as the Christmas decorator, and this is, of course, his busy time.
It's been every single day for 15-hour days, so you and me are talking at 12:20 a.m. I just loaded a Christmas tree into the back of my SUV from a job I was doing.
Clay usually works with some pretty high-end clients.
Well, mostly people who just call me and say, we'd like to do this and this and this and this, and then they don't really ask me how much it costs. And I go do it, and then I bill them, and they pay me.
Let's take this whole thing right here.
He decks the halls of private homes, mansions, and five-star hotels throughout Los Angeles. Clay counts Michael Jackson among his past clients.
Clay is particular.
Lyra Marble is the owner of Mr. Green Trees. For 20 years, Clay's been buying the best trees from her.
He spends a lot of time here, looking through the trees over and over and over again to find just the right one.
Lyra handpicks her inventory in Oregon and Washington, keeps them moist twice a day, and even humidifies the tent.
So we're sort of a very specialty, you know, the spa for Christmas trees.
And they do have spa prices. One of their 14-foot noble fir trees can set you back $2,000. So what would you pay to have someone decorate your mansion? Depending on what you're doing, Clay says it can cost $3,000, or you might add a zero.
If you're doing something on a really, really big scale, and we're doing garlands on every window and putting 9 Christmas trees inside your home, yeah, it would be a lot.
Despite the expense, Clay is booked solid with more than 40 clients this year. In Brentwood, Compardi's Chocolates has almost more customers than it can handle.
But that's what they say, 'tis the season. This is our season. These 3 weeks are do or die for my business.
Jonathan Graham is the owner of Compardi's Chocolates. Compardi's hand makes beautiful chocolate truffles with exotic flavors like wasabi ginger and peanut honey sea salt.
We're in Brentwood, so we have the cream of the crop elite people.
People who can afford to order almost $13,000 of chocolate to complete their holiday gift list.
People call it the biggest chocolate box you've ever seen in your life. It's $160, and this person came in and ordered 80 of them. So that's 6,400 pieces, handmade, just for one client's order.
The holiday season is everything to these business owners. For Clay, the Christmas decorator, these few months of hard work will support him and his partner for the rest of the year.
I still act, and I still do Shakespeare, but I get to do Christmas, and it keeps me in theater. And my apartment in New York and my house in Los Angeles, so I'm lucky.
In Los Angeles, I'm Eric Drachman for Marketplace.
Members of Congress are home for the holidays. They started the recess after passing a 2-year budget deal. Now, there are optimists who believe the door is open, that there's breathing room, as some say, for lawmakers to tackle other issues. One of those is immigration. The Senate has passed a bill. The House has not. Well, when immigration is in the news, scam artists see an opportunity. They'll tell immigrants they can help them get green cards, even when these swindlers know full well many of their prospective clients aren't eligible. Here's Alexandra Starr in New York.
When he moved from India to the United States 11 years ago, Karan could not believe his luck. A U.S. tech firm had sponsored him for a visa, and he was going to live in San Francisco. But when he arrived, he got chilling news. The company had folded. And that meant Karan's H-1B visa was no longer valid.
Probably I was illegal from day one in this country.
For most of the next decade, Karan lived here illegally. He moved to New York and did odd jobs to get by. What he wanted was a work permit so he could apply for other tech positions. An acquaintance told Karan he knew someone who could help.
He told me that, this guy is good and he can help you get these papers.
Karan went to see the attorney, Earl David. He promised he could get Karan a work permit and a green card for $20,000.
That was the reason we fall for them. They're charging so much money, probably they are the right persons to go to.
Karan's confidence in David only grew after the lawyer got him a work permit, as promised. Turns out, though, the whole thing was a sham. Earl David was filing phony documents with the authorities. He was even creating shell companies that allegedly hired his immigrant clients. After a while, David stopped returning Karan's calls, and so Karan went to see another attorney, Alan Kay.
I tried to warn him that even though he got a work permit, the case was going to crash and burn.
Kay was right. Karan received a letter telling him he was in deportation proceedings. Kay says that while immigration fraud is always a problem,
you see a spike when there's more talk about legalization, and that's right now.
The Federal Trade Commission operates a database where immigrants can report fraud. Michael Waller works in the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the commission. He urges immigrants who have been victims to come forward.
I can't emphasize enough, the most important thing that people can do to help stop this fraud is to file complaints. Law enforcement needs those complaints in order to identify targets.
The problem is, the victims are mostly undocumented. And as lawyer Alan Kay points out, they're scared.
They're afraid of what's going to happen to them. Are they going to be deported? Are they going to get turned in? Are they going to get locked up?
Authorities did find people to testify against Earl David, though. Of course, he did swindle more than 25,000 immigrants. David pleaded guilty to fraud, and this spring, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In New York, I'm Alexandra Starr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, first of all, I love this world of stratospheric high finance where, you know, bets are not for millions, but for billions of dollars.
A new novel explores the intersection of high finance and international terrorism. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets and plenty of others are closed today, so we're going to do the numbers holiday style. First, the big picture. According to a Pew Research study, 92% of Americans are celebrating today. Nearly 80% will put up a tree. Sales of live trees could surpass $1 billion this year. But fakes own the holiday now, and if you've got a fake tree, it probably came from China. It shipped 90 million of them during the first 9 months of the year. Finally, if you're a sports fan looking for an excuse to spend the day in front of the tube, well, there are 5 NBA games today. Stephen Curry, Chris Paul, they also didn't get the day off. So the lesson here seems to be if you want to make the big bucks, well, you got to work on Christmas. Not sure that applies to public radio. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. Not happy with your presents this year?
Well, it's National Winers Day, dedicated to winers and those who return or exchange their Christmas gifts. The 7-day festival of Kwanzaa begins, and the holiday continues with Boxing Day. Think of it as the world's Black Friday. And though it's not big here in the U.S., you might just find some great online deals. I'm Denise Guerra.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. The civil war in Syria has been going on for more than 2.5 years now. More than 2 million Syrians have fled the country. The majority of them cross the border into Lebanon, where they try to find space in cities and refugee camps that are already crowded. And Lebanon has asked the international community for help. Germany says it'll host 5,000 refugees for 2 years. Caitlin Carroll reports on what it's like to leave a war zone to start a new life in one of Europe's richest countries.
First stop is Friedland, a sprawling refugee complex in central Germany. This is where the Syrian refugees spend their first 2 weeks getting acclimated. They start with a crash course in all things German. A few families sit in a classroom staring at a map of Germany while the teacher describes the country's political system. A translator repeats everything in Arabic. Hassan Otman listens closely. The 27-year-old is here with part of his 9-member family. The Otmans flew from Lebanon to Germany a few days ago.
Right now we cannot believe it. It's like a dream come true. We are in Germany, finally.
The Otmans' road to Germany was a long one. They left Syria more than a year ago and moved to Beirut, Lebanon, hoping to find work and a quiet place to live. But that didn't last long.
After just like a few months, we heard explosions and bombs and everything happened. So my family also terrified, and all my little brothers, they said it's going to happen just like what happened in Syria.
They decided to try to move again, this time to Germany. After a series of interviews with embassy and UN officials, their names were added to the list of the initial 5,000 Syrians taking part in a new program. Heinrich Hornschmeier is the head of the Friedland Refugee Center. He says the program serves those who meet special criteria. The refugees coming to Germany will mostly be families, those who are ill or handicapped, and those with special skills or education to help rebuild Syria post-crisis.
So the group is very young, the number of children is very high, and we have relatively few single travelers.
At Friedland, German officials provide the Syrians with 2-year work permits and register them for social services. Then, after a few weeks, regional representatives pick up the refugees and drive them to their new homes, scattered across Germany. Hornschmeier says this is when the initial excitement fades.
When the reality of their situation hits them over weeks and months, then they become more cautious and the excitement of their first days slows down.
Most refugees have no idea what to expect. Housing varies depending on the city, as does the attitude of their neighbors. Some Germans are supportive of the program and put up signs welcoming the Syrians, while others have protested against the refugees, most recently in a working-class neighborhood of Berlin. Hassan's mother, Jamina, is staying positive. She wants to enroll her 2 youngest children in school and create stability for the family.
It's going to be difficult from the beginning, and step by step, we're going to get used to.
Hassan is already thinking about finding a job. He used to work at a big hotel, but now dreams of life as an airport employee. His one big concern is that all of his certificates and diplomas are back in Syria.
I came here with nothing, and I only have the knowledge, and I know what to work and what to do.
And he hopes that will be enough to build a new life in Germany. In Friedland, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
To shift gears for a moment to talk about jobs on a day when I hope you got a break from yours. We're asking people to tell us stories about their first jobs, what they learned, what stayed with them, and what they still think about.
My name is Michael Price. I am a writer and co-executive producer on The Simpsons.
My first job was working at a women's clothing store in a mall in the little town I grew up in called South Plainfield, New Jersey, a store that I think is not there anymore. It was called Burt's, and it was a kind of a specialty mid-range women's clothing store where I was the stock boy. And I inherited this job from a friend of mine who had left the job. It was my senior year of high school, and it was the first job I drew a paycheck on. I cleaned the floors with one of those kind of mop thingies with a big, long, wide wand. I broke up boxes, and I put the boxes in the dumpster, and I spent the rest of the time sort of hiding in the back room or spending long times in the bathroom because I didn't like the job very much, but I needed the money, probably around $38 or $40 a week. It was a very simple job. Like I said, I didn't have to do very much, but I didn't like being among people. I didn't have to sell anything, but occasionally I have to sort of open up boxes full of, you know, women's clothing. And it was all sort of embarrassing to me because I grew up in a family of all boys. I had no sisters. I was painfully shy around girls. And here I was working in a women's clothing store where there are women and girls walking around all the time. And I really had no clue what to do about it. I spent my break times going to a little bookstore across the hall in the mall where I just sort of spent my time reading books about what I end up doing now, which is TV and comedy. So I spent all my money on those books about Saturday Night Live and Second City TV and things like that. Well, the one thing I could say about my first job is that it really did help sort of inform my writing as a comedy writer because it was an incredibly awkward situation. And looked at objectively, if it was a TV show or a movie, it would be pretty funny. The nerdiest geek, you know, working, you know, with these sort of somewhat stylish women, you know, and having really no clue what to do about it. And that, I think that sort of helps inform my writing even today of sort of like looking for juxtaposition of people forced into a situation that really makes no sense for them.
We want to hear your stories about your first job, whether they're funny, sad, or shocking. Tweet them to us at Marketplace APM. Author Christopher Reich is a master of what's called the financial thriller. The economy, the financial markets, these themselves are important characters. Reich's newest book is The Prince of Risk. Its main character is Bobby Astor, a successful hedge fund manager who's the son of the chief executive of the New York Stock Exchange. Astor has placed a $1 billion bet on the value of China's currency when he gets some startling news. His dad has died, and so has the Treasury Secretary and the chairman of the Fed after a secret meeting in Washington. Christopher Reich, the author of The Prince of Risk, joins us from San Diego. Hey, Christopher.
Hello, David.
I want to start by, you know, I'm somebody who covers this stuff regularly, has to report on the Federal Reserve, and I got to tell you that I'm always aware that something like PMI or GDP, this is stuff that's not always the most exciting thing to listeners, but here there's a lot of intrigue.
Well, I think that the, you know, what has to do with the economy goes far beyond just those dry statistical numbers. And here in The Prince of Risk, we're dealing with a threat to the very financial underpinnings of the United States economy.
Your main character is Bobby Astor. He's a guy who runs a big hedge fund, number of funds, actually. And the pressure's really on him. Maybe you can just describe what he's trying to do.
Well, first of all, I love this world of stratospheric high finance where, you know, bets are not for millions but for billions of dollars. And so much can hang in the balance on one decision on which way the market will turn. In The Prince of Risk, Bobby Astor, who's this kind of hedge fund supremo based on so many of these big personalities we read about, he has made a bet on the Chinese yuan, the Chinese currency, and he thinks the yuan will depreciate in value, which is against what everyone else thinks. So he's taking the contrarian view.
And this is not a job for the faint of heart. There's a lot of stress here.
That's what's so exciting about it is, and I think that's what turns on these hedge fund managers, is they're sitting there putting, you know, billion-dollar bets down on the market and seeing if they are correct or not, and everything hangs in the balance.
You, as I understand, started out in finance, and as you were writing this book, I imagine you talked to a bunch of people in this field. How much has the business of finance changed?
When I first got my MBA and became a stockbroker and then worked in mergers and acquisitions, most of the trading was done or a large portion by the simple consumer. Now it's really dominated, and I'm talking about trading on New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and exchanges all over the world by hedge funds, private equity firms, and institutional investors. Us simple consumers who have 100 or 200 shares of IBM, we're kind of on the side really just having to watch without much influence on which way the market's going to go.
There are all these variables at play in your book, things that could affect this one trade that Bobby Astor has made. And one of them is a plan for a terrorist attack that's kind of modeled off of one that happened in India just a couple of years ago. Just talk about how something like that can really affect the markets.
I was really concerned or interested in this shoot and scoot attack, which took place in Mumbai about 5 years ago, where 15 attackers, hardly trained at all, with machine guns, poor cell phones, went in, landed by boat, and basically paralyzed a 16-million-person city. The city of Mumbai brought it to an economic standstill for 3 days and sadly killed about 200 people, burned down a hotel. But it took only 16 people to wreak untold billions of dollars of economic havoc. And I explored this and say, how could this happen in a city like New York? You know, I grew up reading the classics, Robert Ludlum, Frederick Forsyth, Tom Clancy, and they always ask what might happen in certain situations. And the Prince of Risk is looking at what might happen if a foreign government, through investments in our financial system, in private equity firms and hedge funds, was able to manipulate events to their advantage. And it's very, very scary. We are very vulnerable.
Christopher Reich's new book is called The Prince of Risk. Christopher, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, maybe one of the presents you ordered didn't make it to your house in time to put beneath the tree. Well, FedEx and UPS say some shipments were delayed this year. Why? Heavy volume. In other words, because you sent too many packages, people. Last week, UPS delivered 132 million of them. On Monday alone, Big Brown had to process 7.75 million shipments. So a note to shoppers, remember, all those promises made in the online world about what'll get where by when, they still have to be carried out in the real world. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today for the Christmas holiday. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.